Case 47 of the woman Guan, Do Shui's three barriers. The priest Do Shui set up three barriers in order to examine his students. You make your way through the darkness of abandoned grasses in a single-minded search for your self-nature. Now, honored one, where is your nature? When you have realized your self-nature, you are free from birth and death. When the light of your eyes falls, how are you free? When you are free of birth and death, you know where to go. When your five elements scatter, where do you go? Please sit comfortably. I love this case. I understand it in the Takujo line of Linji Zen. We belong to the Takujo in the Inzan line of Linji Zen. Where they take the way they structure the koans, they begin with, very much like us, with mu and a set of introductory koans, and they end very much like we do, with an investigation of the five ranks and the precepts. In the middle, we do it a little differently. In Takucho, our style, we use the actual traditional books, the cases as they are anthologized. In the Inzan line, they do an in-house ordering of many of the cases. And they take this one, Do Shui's Three Barriers, and they put it very near the end, just before you go on into the five ranks and the precepts. Our master, Hakuin Dayun, decided that this was sufficiently important and could be looked at in so many different ways that we, as many in this room know, encounter it for the first time near the end of our miscellaneous collection. Not precisely at the beginning of our practice, but very much early on in our encountering the matter through koan introspection. I know that when I wrote my first book on Zen and I wanted to present the fundamental questions, this is the case that I turned to. And I still find myself haunted by it. It seems that we come in with many different stories about why it is we take up the Zen way. And they're all over the map. I want to improve my tennis game. Is among my favorites. Because someone has died, because of precarious health, any number of questions kind of pull us into this practice. But I think after we've sat with it a little while, we begin to see there really seem to be just these three things. The question of dying, the question of death, and the question of how do we engage this whole matter. We could order them in any number of ways, but Do Shui picked his ranking of you're wandering through the grasses as you die, when you have died. He's an interesting fellow. We don't know tons about him. He was, as a young monk, apparently particularly fast and intelligent and arrogant. And there's an encounter story in which he is challenged on that and set up that first of several times when he demonstrated the heart of our way in bowing and finding the humility of his way. In fact, after he became a teacher, he took off the brown robe and put the black robe back on in order to continue his training when he felt he did not have his have quite the insight that he felt necessary for the heavy obligations of guiding others. He died young, 48, and I don't believe there are any direct lineage heirs, but we're all his heirs. We all get something out of this case, among the most important for me, as I said, and maybe for all of us. Let's look at that first part. You make your way through the darkness of abandoned grasses in a single-minded search for your self-nature. You make your way through the darkness of abandoned grasses in a single-minded search for your self-nature. I rehearsed a little bit of my biography earlier this week, and my wandering and lost years and found years. And the truth is, we all have these kind of narrative accounts, these stories that create out of the years of our lives, school or work, romantic encounters, no romantic encounters, whatever it is becomes this stuff that is our path. Much of it is illuminating, much of it is very much these abandoned grasses. Along with the joys, there are these losses. Along with the successes, there are failures. Each one of these presents something for us. And our master, Do Shui, says, "Now, honored one, now, dear one, now, beloved, now, where is your nature?"
So the task falls to me to talk about the second part of this case. And, of course, we have to remember that Dao Shui is a bit of a trickster to us. He's pointing at things that seem apparent and simple, but really they're freighted, as James said, with our histories and our stories. And I can't remember if you said this, James, but this case comes very close to the end of the Gateless Gate, Wu Men's collection, as well as coming towards the end of our miscellaneous koans. For it to repeat like this, it kind of underlines its importance, I would say. The importance that we have been going into over the past few days about facing life as it actually is, facing death as it actually is, and then to see through, of course, our endless speculations about life and death. Because isn't the whole point of this practice that we're engaged in to see through our endless constructions, to get out of the construction business, to see life for what it is? And so Dao Shui is using a lot of metaphors here. In the first part, these grasses, we can all relate to them. It's a great metaphor. And then we come to the second part, when you have realized your self nature, you will be free of birth and death. It sounds great. I'm all for this. Let's be free of birth and death. Okay, done. But not done, never done. So being free of birth and death, this is something that every single one of us must encounter again and again, because the stories of our death are so deeply implanted. That is, the fantasies about our death are so deeply implanted, sometimes so buried that we don't even wake to them until we have to. My old teacher always used to quote a Christian mystic named Abraham de Sancta Clara, who used to say, "The one who dies before he dies, when he dies, will not die." If you understand that, then you maybe are already free of birth and death. But what is this dying before we die? How do we become free? It always reminds me of one of my favorite stories from the TNG koan collection, Star Trek: The Next Generation. Some of you who know the program might remember that Jean-Luc Picard, at one point, they're on the Enterprise deck, all hanging out, as they tend to do, and suddenly this mysterious probe shows up in the big window and focuses its beam on Jean-Luc, and he falls to the ground as if dead. So the story keeps cutting back to what's going on in his mind and what's going on the Enterprise deck, where everyone is in a panic trying to revive him. He's not dead, but he appears to be dead. And this goes on for about 25 minutes. Meanwhile, in Jean-Luc Picard's mind, he has been transported to another planet, a planet that doesn't have space technology and that is dying. And he's a young man, and he finds out that he's married and has children, whole life that he is living. And through the years of this life, he ages, his wife dies. Because of his knowledge of science, he tries to help this dying planet, but as a very, very old man with his children grown, he sees a little missile being launched, and he asks someone from his feeble, aged, dim sight and dim voice, "What is that?" And they say, "The planet will die soon. So we've put all of the knowledge of this planet into that probe, and it will go off and find someone to carry the knowledge." And he says, "Oh, that's me, isn't it?" And then he dies. And then he wakes up on the deck of the Enterprise, a changed person. He's died. He has found a new life. He has a whole set of memories that will never leave him. And the probe, which they've now rescued, and it, which is now no longer holding him, is opened up, and in it there's a little box, and in the box is a little flute, which he had learned to play during his very long life. And he picks up the flute and plays a little tune. This playing a little tune is what that story revolves around. It's a way of expressing life lived fully. How are we free from birth and death? How do we engage with our whole life knowing that it's already over? And yet we have to step forward, step by step, like that man unfolding the rope that he walks upon in the air.
So I think many of you know that we're on a campaign to raise money to purchased the temple, and we've come upon a new idea, which is to start a television channel, which will, instead of television, you'll get to listen to Melissa talking about television, which I think is actually much better. I watched the same episode. These stories that are our lives go by and we miss them. Someone else tells the story. And we go, oh, the flute, the living, the dying. And Buddhism, of course, is one grand television channel. All Buddhism all the time, maybe many different. There's the Tibetan programming early in the morning, and then Theravadins come on at 9 and have the talk channel, and then the test pattern comes on. That's the Zen portion of the Buddhist channel. And of course, the problem with Buddhism is that we think it's something, that we take the stories as real, that we take the stories as if they are about something other than us. And then we fill in our fantasy. Oh, yeah, you know, that's what it's going to be like. And this third barrier. When you are free of birth and death, you know where to go. When your four elements scatter, where do you go? So we put on our best Buddhist thinking cap. All right, emptiness, form, something about this and that, and we try to figure out what's the answer. And we look all around. I think one of the essential teachings of Zen is that we're looking in the wrong place. Because it is so very clear, it is hard to realize. Because it has been here all along, because it is not different from the content of your mind at this moment. We can't imagine what it is. It is not a thing of your imagination. It is not some other life. It is not some great Buddhist life. We are called in our home leaving to come home. We are called to come home where we have been all along, to realize this great matter, to leave behind all of our Zen training, to leave behind all of our ideas. And as we put down the great burden, the great imagined burden that we have been carrying, then we can find our way without a doubt, without a thought. No need to talk about enlightenment or delusion, beginning or ending. Thank you. So, questions? Comments? Yeah.
First of all, we just grew up and I would totally sign up for that channel.
What? I can't hear you, Mike.
I would totally sign up for that channel. This seems to bring up to me another opportunity to talk about near enemies. Because if we're recognizing that we're already dead. We hear Marines or Rangers say, why are you holding back from killing the enemy? You're already dead. Don't worry about it. We talk a lot about this, life, death, and finding your way, we haven't talked a lot about sort of that, maybe the role of the precepts of sort of holding that realization that that maybe you are already dead, but there is something in that, in those grasses that you're certainly, that maybe helps guide you with that realization. I don't know. So you maybe talk more about that. Once you realize this, what then?
Oh, I couldn't understand you until just this moment. So when you realize your true nature and you're free of birth and death, when you know that you're going to die, then what?
Yeah.
I think you said it pretty well. I mean, then we, it's even more important. There's some kind of a clarifying quality. How am I going to live this precious life? This is it. This is the only life I get. In Zen, we don't ask people to believe in past lives or future lives. You know, up to you. But we don't ask for it. We're really interested in how to live this life fully, and as you bring in, and I think it's very important, ethically. Because the near enemy is, who gives a shit? I'm going to die anyway. But I remember Paul said something about this yesterday, you know, this touching into life because of this, and Diane quoting that old woman said, I'm already dead. You know, there's a way to enjoy this life and take responsibility in it because it's so precious. So is that anywhere near where you were going?
So
there's still something.
Just being dead doesn't mean you're free.
Right, it's one of the primary teachings in the Hyakujo and the fox. There are many stories about this, and one of the great misunderstandings of what it means to wake up is that that definition of freedom, I would say, is the near enemy of a true freedom. So to say I can do whatever I want is half true. You know, that's halfway through the journey. And we can get stuck there. James is still stuck.
Very sad. But they're helping.
But when we see through even that great delusion, then it becomes much simpler. Maybe just follow the precepts and be compassionate.
Just got another little glimmer as you were talking. That was very helpful to think about James.
I'm happy to serve.
I'm just kidding. But the opening to the fact that we're going to die could be purely intellectual and deadening, not in a good way. But you know that this aliveness that arises, it is a full-bodied dying the great death. So it really does turn the heart in a different direction. And you know, it's easy to go, the near enemy, I would say, like the most intimate enemy of this, is to have it be intellectual and go into despair and have your life just really be not only who gives a shit, but you know, this deep life sucks and then you die, which you can turn around. Life is full of suffering and I'm alive now, you know, so things don't go away, but they get transformed, they get turned around. You still be angry when you're angry, but you know that it resonates a little differently. Thank you. That's very important.
Jay?
You said living then, so we're going to die, and then compassion living with the precepts. I'd like to hear you speak a little bit how, in your experience, Zen training actually develops compassion, or does it develop compassion? How does that grow in our way?
So, Jay, could I ask you to say just a few words, and then I will, because I think that there's something alive here, and I think something you've seen too.
Well, for me, I want to hear you say.
Since I'm sitting up here, you have to go first.
Okay. So, I just find it really mysterious, but really palpable, that somehow sitting in this deep mystery, it just takes the heart and gives it. It breaks it, but it gives it some kind of a girth, you know, that is not really accessible in for me in different ways. And I don't. It's very hard for me to articulate it. Like I get tradition envy sometimes, because I think some other traditions have a very clear answer. Oh, if you want to develop compassion, do these things, and I think they're great, you know. But in our way, it's sort of like, well, go to session and that happens. Sit and it happens. But you're not.
Yeah. So I would say go to Sashin and it happens. Sit and it happens. And that it is this mystery, and my experience is like yours. And when you speak from that place, my heart hears you. And we see and we know each other. This, I don't think compassion is something we can cultivate or need to cultivate. It's already boundless. It is the stuff of our life. And when we take away some of those ancient stories of separation and the ancient stories of about ourselves, what we find when we receive our soup from the server is this love and compassion that is freely. We have access to what has been here all along. So no need to cultivate in that sense. And I totally am with you on the mystery of it. I have no clue how this happens, right? But yet, I have no doubt. And I think all of us in our hearts, you look up, you walk out the door, and no need to try to arouse compassion. You know, the flowers are there. You know, somebody walks by on the street. Yeah.
Josh, our mysterious fourth of our threesome, after a series of his own insights and commented on this, and what he said, there's absolutely no reason to assume waking up would be anything but despairing or blankness, or, you know, there's just no particular direction that's obvious. And yet what we encounter is joy, love, compassion. And it is a mystery. And it's the mystery to which we devote our lives.
Mm-hmm. And just to say that there are wonderful techniques. There's even a curriculum on developing compassion that's based on some of those teachings. And I've met the people who've created it. And they're really, really nice people. And there's a little bit of an intellectual side to it. It's like, I'm going to be compassionate. So it gets into near enemy territory. You know, compassion, this arising. They don't have compassion for the flower in the garden, but they're trying to develop it. So it gets a little instrumental and can just drift away from the heart of it. It's great stuff, as I agree. You know, in some ways, I prefer this recognition rather than trying to make it happen.
So, Mike, Steve, and Julie?
For me, one of the things that I found about the arising of compassion is that it has so much to do with sitting with my own failures. for all the times that I'm not awake, for all the times that I'm sitting there and I'm suffering and struggling with my own demons and there's nothing I can seem to do about them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, you know, there it is. Then when you see anybody in that situation, I know you.
Yeah.
Right, and you are me.
Right? Yeah.
Great, thanks. Steve and then Julie.
So I've really been thinking about this term great death ever since Diane mentioned it yesterday. It's been with me as I've been sitting. And so my experience is that when the little self dies for some period of time, it is this compassion, this fullness of heart that shows up. But then I create this idea of this great death where, you know, I kill that little bastard self. And
we're beyond mild distaste.
and then, you know, so it's like day six of session, you know, forever, where, you know, the heart is full of compassion and desire to serve and take care of the one who doesn't get sick. And
keep speaking up the king.
Then the other side of my experience is that doesn't actually happen, or so far it doesn't actually happen, that it's more like, you know, there's a whole bunch of small deaths. You know, I come back to Sishin and I reach this place where my heart is just so full, and I'm just, you know, I go home and you know, my little self comes back again, and I go back into that place of being irritated with my life, and I think, you know, what is going on? You know, why? What is this great death? So.
James will speak to that.
Yeah. He's making a circle.
No, he's not.
The spiral. He's saying it for the
time. It's going downward.
You can, it was my spiral. You can take your spiral.
Take your spiral. Take it up. And so all these words we use sounds like there is some fixed point. So we think great death, we think great awakening, and it sounds like it is another mind state. And so we confuse this with something we know. So in that sense, all our language is a near enemy. Anything we say creates an image that is not true, because the thing itself, it is beyond that. And it is. I was spent 2 weeks in Nepal, and we were near the Bodhnath Stupa, and it's pilgrims come and just walk around and around. You can be there at 4 a.m. And hundreds of people just circling this way, circle clockwise, you know, and all through the day. Just walking with prayer beads and without prayer beads, old people, young people. This is the worship. This is the realization. You know, wherever it is. So, Julie.
On this thing of developing compassion, it really didn't work for me until I got to the test pattern channel. I think those other channels have the guides and everything in it. And one of my stories was, I am lacking in compassion relative to people around me. I'm just not, you know, just not happening for me. And until I realized that I had an idea and an image of my head, in my head, about what compassion was, and it looked like personality traits that I'm not strong in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I said, okay, drop that idea, what is compassion? And went back to that test pattern. that feeling that I have to be somebody else to have it let go.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Very important.
Derek.
I think it's important to remember what the Buddha said. He said, out of all the beings in the universe who deserve your compassion, you deserve your compassion. So, I don't know, it's just, you know, we get angry, we get selfish, and when we forgive ourselves and pick apart that and we fix it.
Yeah.
I was sure you were going to quote the test pattern quote.
Yeah, lovely. Great reminder of this. That, and again, it's the self and others. You know, when we really get into the matter, as Mike said, what we see out there in the person who's so irritating or the person who's so lost is us. And we, too, are the other that we need to turn our compassion toward.
So, touching a bit on the cycle that Steve was describing, that, you know, sometimes expanding and open-hearted and compassionate, and then sometimes not. And, you know, sometimes I don't even have to go home to ride
that all the way
so
around.
So advanced.
You know, For example, during the session, you know, the first 3 or 4 days were great, and big open heart, and so glad to be with all of you, and noticing all of these little things that are just so wonderful, and I so appreciate about literally everybody in this room, and, you know, thinking that I'm going to find a way to let you know at some point, and great, and then back around, and, you know, one of the big themes that has emerged for me in the sesshin is the idea of intimacy, which is somehow a slightly different angle on practice than what I have engaged, at least recently. And, you know, intimacy when you're feeling open-hearted and compassionate and, you know, all of that stuff, great, that's good shit, you know? And then, like, intimacy with the pain in my back and my knees and... And then intimacy with anger, and the pain gets worse, and intimacy can fucking hurt, man. And I mean, maybe that's exactly the point, is like, when it fucking hurts, it fucking hurts, and so that's what it is. But, and one of the tricky things about being here is, you know, also watching my mind and realizing that one of the things that I appreciate most about this container is I don't have the option to run away, and the thought has definitely occurred to me. and like, okay, what am I going to do when I get out of here? And what would I do if I was at home? And how would I fix it? And it's like, it doesn't help. And that's one of the things that I appreciate most about being here is that I can't distract myself in those kinds of ways. And it's not like that shit would be an escape anyway, but it's not even an option. And so it hurts, and then I try to turn towards it and practice intimacy with it, and it hurts more. Like, not a little more, a lot more. And there's nowhere to go, and nothing to do, so I find myself sitting more and hurting more. And trying not to just be sitting here waiting for it to turn around again and for that shit to stop. And I don't know if there was a question in there.
Very well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good presentation.
Well, and there are, for me at those moments, there is something of... we call shigyo practice, practicing dying, moving into that place, and it may, and without knowing whether it will kill us or not. You know, that you know, I think we all have those places that are so intense But somehow this supports us instead of the habitual behavior of running away, to head in, and reminded of the movie picture I have of the two Native Americans that are about to, you know, ride into war, and one turns to the other and says, "It's a good day to die." And I think that our practice requires that at some point. And it's not wrong when it seems like, well, I'm in the wrong place, but it's exactly the blessing is that we can't avoid it. And there's some possibility then to die. And it is not the poetic dying that we read about. It is the exact one you describe.
And it's so easy to have that idea that, okay, if I become really intimate with this pain, whether it's psycho-emotional or just the pain in my knees or my back, then it'll go. Like, that's the deal, right? I get intimate with this shit, and then it'll stop. And we can go back to some blissful state. And that hasn't happened yet, at least not over here.
Well, it's using practice as a technique, using intimacy as a technique. And you see right through it, don't you? I mean, at this moment, you do. But about halfway through the afternoon, when your knees are on fire, and you just feel like nobody and nothing, and, oh, I'm never going to get into Sudoku-san again, and they hate me, and it must be a plot. I think that was another Star Trek episode.
Captain Picard couldn't get in for Doksan.
He pulled out his phaser. He's like, but you know, this is you can say that thing. If I become intimate, I will feel better. And that's, you know, not this practice. It's not the practice I'm dying. And I could see it. You got it. Yeah. It hit you, right? Yeah. It's very. This practice is pretty ruthless. And again, please be careful. All these words, you know, they say the word Buddha and you should wash out your mouth for 3 days. all these are words, the great death, the little death, the great self, the little self, you know, great emptiness. They're just, they're stories. And the reality is that I believe that everybody's waking up all the time. But one of the things we're doing here is we're creating a context so that when these little moments of, oh, come up, we actually recognize them. And they, and not as escapes, but as ways to go right into our life, to really be alive. This is about really being alive. It's not about being dead. More words. Thank you.
Can I respond really quickly?
Yeah.
So for me, it has been hugely important to become that one that wants to run away so desperately, and to not actually run away has been incredibly powerful for me. So that's
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Michael.
I just had a question. So was it me?
Yeah.
You know, that situation of becoming very intimate with, we have this experience and it feels that the suffering is, you know, huge now. How is this helping to reduce suffering, which is at the heart of this?
Please?
You me.
To the monk on the second seat.
Give a talk.
I already gave my talk.
Yeah. My story, my
talk. Oh boy. So I guess I have two thoughts to that. One is that what Steve just said about becoming it. Becoming, in my case, it's not anger, but it's more of a kind of longing sensation. So, becoming the longing, and allowing myself to even speak from that place is a powerful thing. It's like becoming yourself. And then the other part of it is, I think. think there's a certain, the other part of it that I feel like is important to me in my practice is that it's also not entirely true that, you know, I'm fully absorbed in this thing that is, you know, the word delusion is part of our, I think, lexicon for a reason. It's there's a way that I'm really fully absorbed in something that is not entirely true. Mm-hmm. And so, but I don't see that when I don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I hope you understand that answer.
Thank you.
Whoever that was,
the very deep, very grateful. You know, there's also this. I keep going back to what Mike said and what Jay said. You know, and what David said about the arising of compassion as being so natural because the world is full of it, but we're so busy running our little trips to delusion world. Which is another fundraiser.
That's a TV series.
No, really, I think that's in the basement.
I see a theme park.
Delusion world. So we're so busy that we don't see the water we're swimming in, which is made of compassionate elements, made of kindness. Mm. And so, you know, of course, that's not to discount the terrible things we do to each other, but this is what prevents us, perhaps, in our delusion from doing, maybe it helps us do fewer harmful things. And the precepts are really helpful with that. There's no question, because it's so easy to get off. These near enemies, they will have one of the rides will be the near enemies. Yeah. It'll go in a cycle. You can't get off of it.
But every time, and then you get sick at the end.
Every time you whip around to the beginning, it's different. And so this I think is really, really important to realize that we have a responsibility as people who've learned to practice kindness towards ourselves, who have witnessed the arising of compassion, to then go out into the world and continue this. This is, the world and Sesshin are not different places. I don't know if you know that. We still get the mail, and we have to take out the garbage, and you have to go to the bathroom, and you have to sleep, right? We're not on some cloud here. But we make differences. So the kindness we brought to ourselves on the cushion, this very thing that we're pointing out, has to keep going. And it's hard, and not in some zenny weird form, but just in meeting everything that we meet with kindness and with the structure of the precepts. Otherwise, we turn into monsters. And we're not interested in that. At least we're hoping not to be interested in it. James, see.
Okay. Are we done? Is there still time?
I think so.
Okay.
All right, what do you think?
I think we're done.
No. Sorry. It never hangs up.
James. Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
So a couple of things come up for me. One is this idea, when thinking about the great death, that it's, you know, similar to enlightenment, right? That it's like, it's something other than this, right? That, well, this can't be it, right? It has to be something else. And so we do stuff, right? Like, well, let me dig through this, and on the other side of it will be the great death.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be working. It's something else, right? It's that thing about throwing yourself at the ground and missing. Right? You know, it's an accidental dropping out of the way, and some noticing that it's always been true.
That works.
That works.
Thank you.